So painkillers and gummy bears, a mother and son's journey through fear to freedom. Gail Stuart Freire, Christopher Thomas Stuart, co-authors. So this book is, Gail started writing, what, a year ago? No. 3 years ago, and now it's here and it's out. And if you'll read it, get some tissue. And because it talks about some sad things, some real things in life and death, suffering, how that works, how that doesn't work, community, family. It's just packed full of things that we all deal with in life. So I thought it would be a good idea because there's some great themes in here, and we talk through some questions to ask. So we're going to have a little question and answer with Gail, author, Jeff, brother, and Pastor David, who was a pastor here. When did you retire? 2006? He doesn't remember. It's 2005, some years ago, but was involved with Christopher quite a bit. So we're going to come on up and we'll find our places here. And yes. All right.
Okay.
Can you hear Gail if she speaks?
Can you hear me if I speak?
Yes.
Yes?
And Jeff?
Can you hear this?
Yes. And then you'll hear David because he's David. And as a... Gail, why don't you just say... Why? Why on this? Just give a why on the book. Just a quick why.
Why I wrote it?
Yeah. Yeah.
I wrote the book... It was titled Painkillers and Gummy Bears because Christopher wanted to write this book. Christopher was a really wonderful writer. And
better writer than her, by the way.
Yeah. Eric offended me the other day by saying that my son was a better writer. But no, that's totally true. My son was a far better writer. And anyway, he wanted to write this book. And when he was going through his stem cell transplant for cancer... I think that was kind of one of those things that kept him going, and it's like, I'm going to beat this because I'm going to write this book. And so the kind of family conversation over the years was, who's going to write Christopher's book? And none of us thought that we had the ability to do it. And then I had a conversation with my mom's cousin who really inspired me to give it a try. And this is what happened 3 years later. So, and with a wonderful editor that you'll meet at the book signing if you come today.
Which is after the second service.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. So can I just ask quickly, how many people lived through this with me during the...
Yes, and within this community here. So
right.
Some you.
Okay, some, okay.
You know the
yes.
story.
It was, yes. It was a family and community affair. Right.
I'm trying to find the questions for you. All right. Here's the first question. And this relates to all of you. In your book, you have, and this is Pastor Beth's question, the virtual question from Pastor Beth. In your, and we, I said it for 20 minutes. So 20 minutes, and then we'll probably go fast. In your, or someone else said it for 20 minutes, because I'm going to forget. If you have a clock, tell me when 20 minutes is up. In your book, you have a recurring question. How does a mother deal with all of this? How did you deal with all this? And that'll be the same question for you, Jeff, and then for you, David, how you dealt with it. So how did you deal with all of this?
Well, everyone assumes that I was... So
maybe say what happened just quickly.
Oh, okay, yeah. I'm sorry. For people that don't know me and haven't read the book, what the book is about is my younger son, Christopher, when he was 15, got a virus, or just a random virus that destroyed his heart. And he ended up having a heart transplant. Oh, that's better. He ended up having a heart transplant about 30 days later. And he lived with that for 6 years, and then he developed a cancer from most likely from the immunosuppressive drugs that he had to take for his heart, and he battled that for a year before he passed away. And after the heart transplant, Christopher did a lot of journaling that was very private to him, and much that we didn't see until after he passed away. And and he did recordings during his stem cell transplant, and So those things that were used in the book. And then kind of the stress of 7 years of, a very, very chronically medically fragile child caused our marriage to fall apart. And my mom died in that period of time, too. Jeff decided to sail around the world. Hopefully he'll address why he did that.
I never thought it landed in that category.
And then it's kind of, the book is kind of about how we all emerged, resilient, more authentic, and in my mind, for me, with a much deeper faith, much closer to God.
And let me just say before you answer, the reason why they're here today is because, you know, preaching is about speaking the truth and looking into the Word and testimony, that's what this is. This is the testimony of a life that relates very much to how you look at God and Jesus. So this is testimony. You're hearing a story, our bigger story of Jesus and this particular story of how that works there. So, Jeff, how about you? How did you deal with it?
Poorly.
And go ahead.
So,
a little closer.
Oh yeah. So, shortly after, about a year after that, I left on a travel the world trip, which was partially a go and explore, partially run away, because this was Christopher died, my parents' marriage falling apart, all of these the things that I had always assumed would be there, the foundation kind of just got pulled away, and I was in kind of a free fall, I guess. And I would not recommend isolating yourself on a boat in an ocean as a healthy path for dealing with grief. That's, but I think through that, I was the benefits for me of that is that I was able to kind of flush a good deal of my life or the anxieties around having a job and having all those things that I think that if I didn't do that, I would have attempted to return back to quote unquote normal, and never have really dealt with or held or succumbed to the grief. I think it taught me a lot about trying to control things. So one of the things that when Christopher first got sick, I'm an engineer. I'm going to fix this. So I'm going to learn everything about cardiology and heart transplants. And at some point, Christopher was like, dude, you need to quit this because I don't need a doctor. I've got a lot of doctors. Yeah. I need a brother. So I'm not going to listen to anything you have to say about this anymore.
Right.
Yeah. I was a little worried when he decided that he was going to go from engineering to cardiology. And for a couple of years in college, he tried to take all pre-med electives and engineering courses, which is a heck of a load.
Yes.
Work-wise. He was a little intense during that time.
And Pastor David, if you could grab the mic and share, how does a pastor work this through and what? Tell us.
Christopher's dying, you mean?
Yeah.
Well, you know, some of these people know, when I was here,
a little closer.
We had a lot of tragic funerals, just young people, and I knew Christopher really well because, you know, he was sick for a long time. And we would have lunch together, and I knew him really well, and he was 22 when he died, and I said, I can't do it. You know, it really gets to you. I mean, that was really tough. And I didn't want to do that again. I said, you know, I'll get through this one, but I don't know. I don't know if I can do this again.
Right.
I think I retired when I did. I retired for a number of reasons. You know, I mean, I had my own health issues. You know, bypass and AAAs and all that, and so that was significant. And when your spouse works Monday through Fridays and you work. So, you know, we thought weekends would be nice. You know?
Yeah.
Just that whole image of Mary and I having a weekend. But also Christopher's thing, I don't know if I can do this again.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
It's real.
We just do that, and then you have to work again the next day. You know, I think pastors ought to take 2 weeks and sail around the world.
They need to get away. Yeah.
Anyway, so I didn't necessarily deal with it well, but.
Yeah. Well, and when did it? When did Brian die in relation to Christopher? And then Frankie? When was?
98.
98. Okay.
So
okay.
My son-in-law died in 98, and then Frankie. And
right. Then Frank and Killa, Andy Waterman. There was a lot of death in for a
death
short period.
Death is horrible,
of time.
But when they're young, it's just that it's just not right. It's not right. The order is not right. Nothing's right about it at all.
Right. You asked how did I deal with it? How does a mother deal with this? You have no choice.
That's a good, great answer. Because you don't, as a parent, you have no choice.
You have no choice. You know, you do the best you can, and you have no choice. You know, if you choose to stay and love your family, you have no choice. You suck it up and you do what you have to do, and that is why I could not have done that without my God. There's no way I could have done that without God and this larger community.
I think you have no choice matches a lot with what you can control and can't control as well. I mean, those are two sides of the same thing.
Right.
So the next question is on the back of your book. Mm-hmm. There's a cool quote here. Well, it's not that cool, I guess. If you think about it. But so, here's the quote. Suffering first breaks you, then strengthens you. Suffering first breaks you, then strengthens you. Mm-hmm. Tell us more about that.
All right. Well, I have an Annie Lamott quote from Help, Thanks, Wow. And this book was not around at that time. It would have been really helpful if it would have been. But this is one of my favorite books. And so the breaking you, and then this is her quote. I love this. There's freedom in hitting bottom, in seeing that you won't be able to save or rescue your daughter, your son, her spouse, his parents, or your career. Relief in admitting you've reached the place of great unknowing. This is where restoration can begin. Because when you're still in the state of trying to fix the unfixable, which is control the uncontrollable, everything bad is engaged. The chatter of your mind, the tension of your physiology, all the trunks and wheel-ons you carry from the past. It's exhausting. It's crazy-making. Help. Help us walk through this. Help us come through. It is the first great prayer.
Thank you. That's excellent. So the next question you all know about, but I want Jeff to answer it first because it's a good answer. I like your answer. If Christopher walked in right now, what would he say to us?
I got it.
It should be on. Yeah, it's on. Yeah.
He'd say, dude, I just had the craziest dream. And then you'd ask to borrow money from me.
He'd come in and say, I need a hug.
Yes.
I need a hug. The other thing is, if Christopher had made it through, he would have been in Palestine and Israel.
Right.
You know that. And he would have come back and given us a lecture on the whole situation over there and what we ought to be doing about it.
Right.
Those two things.
Right. He was very into international politics in the Middle East. And when David would have lunch with him every Wednesday, David learned far more about the Middle East than he ever cared to know.
He would talk 45 minutes about what... all that stuff. But that was really, really important to him.
Uh-huh. Right.
Is this working?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yep.
You know, that in those years when he was at Evergreen going through all that stuff, that really kept him going. That was really vital to him.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So he had great professors over there. You know, one thing when I was rereading this, he had a really good Mr. Krupp or whatever his name was. Mm-hmm.
Mr. Krupp.
Who was taught English and got him writing. That was really important guy. And these guys at evergreen and got them into that. They were really significant people.
Yeah, they were. There would not be a book without Mr. Krupp, because Mr. Krupp was the English teacher that made him journal 6 pages a week during his English class, and he could journal on anything he wanted, and so he did. When I thought of that question, the first thing I thought is that he would come in. He was not. He spoke a bit crassly at times, but I think what he would say is, you all need to get your heads out of your you-know-what, and you need to realize that life is precious, and it's short, and you need to enjoy and cherish every moment.
And I think that's one of the key pieces of the book is that, I mean, especially when you hear from someone who's not around, but when he was around, I mean, he was very wise and very thoughtful and very reflective and very deep. Mm-hmm. And that's reflected in his, you know, all those wonderful journal entries, and just there's lots of just beautiful nuggets of, you know, just wisdom. Mm-hmm. Wisdom. Mm-hmm. Not bad for a kid.
No, not bad for a kid. When you grow up that fast, you kind of get wise.
All right, here's another question that I asked a friend of mine gave me, which I thought was pretty good. Uh-huh. This is for you, Gail. Uh-huh. What did you hear in the middle of your suffering that helped you or was helpful? Well, any of you can answer that. And what can you say to someone who is suffering like you and Christopher did?
What helped me, the whole transplant time, I think, was a bit of a different time. Because we were still trying to, carry on with life and do all that kind of stuff. But when we got down to the cancer part, and I had to, I had to really, really, I had to leave work. I took a leave from work. I had to figure out that I needed to be sober during that period of time. And so I started going to 12-step meetings for alcohol. And I just want to read a little part. It says, as I kept going to the 12-step meetings and with the burden of my job removed, I began to experience a sense of peace and centeredness like I had never known. I would later realize it was a spiritual awakening, but at the time, all I knew was that the craving for alcohol stopped, the chattering voices in my head stopped, and I felt a deep peace in the middle of the toughest time in my life. My mind stopped living in the future where fear and dread resided, and in the past where all regrets lay. All the taunting, awful voices that had driven me to succeed my entire adult life came to a halt. And for the first time in my life, I knew with the expression, the peace that passes all understanding met. I started reading a little recovery meditation book my father had given me. It helped me get sober many years before. Each day had a little reflection, things like where life as a loose garment, all in God's world is fundamentally well. Loosen your hold on earth, its cares and its worries. Live in the world and yet live apart with God. So those sorts of things, just there were certain phrases and meditations that just would fly off the page to me and go right into my heart, and I just knew that, you know, God had given me that peace and that ability to do what I needed to do, which was not freak out, but be the best caregiver I could be for Christopher and for Jeff. I mean, I really needed to be there for my son too. Unfortunately, I wasn't there for my husband as I should have been. I just didn't have, like you'd say, the bandwidth. I didn't have the bandwidth at that time. I my priority was Christopher and Jeff, and I think God helped me really be pretty steady during that time.
Yeah. I just remember you listening to a lot of Eckhart Tolle and knitting.
They knew I'd really changed when I was sitting in for those of you that know Eckhart Tolle and The Power of Now, those tapes were incredibly helpful to me. And me, the frantic, crazy, you know, can't ever stop sitting, was sitting in the kitchen knitting, listening to CDs. My kids thought I'd gone over the edge. But they kind of liked it because I wasn't being such a twit, right? I was kind of being there.
I can't imagine that, by the way.
I know. I've lost some of that calm over the years.
Okay, one last question. And this is has to do with, there's a snippet where Chris writes about the transition between having his heart and then having a new heart, and that there's just this kind of profound sacredness to all that experience, you know, with life and death and how the transfer. I mean, there's lots of things going on. So can you say, or what can you say about death and sacredness? How is death sacred?
Do you want to take that one first, David? I can say I've witnessed 4 deaths, my mom and my dad and Christopher and blanking on the 4th. But anyway, and I have found that in each case, it was an incredibly sacred time. The last week of Christopher's life, I have a little paragraph that says, "The time I spent with him that week was often passed in peaceful silence. I felt a loving energy in the room that communicated all that was needed. We were at peace. Nothing more needed to be said. Christopher knew I loved him completely, and I knew he would always be with me, just not in the physical body."
And that's, I've always made that kind of experience of death as like birth as well. I mean, it's the same kind of way, you know. I mean, that's what I think. Death is the bookend of coming into the world, you know, the sacredness of life.
Right.
Any other thoughts? Not required, just...
I think that for me it was that death, Christopher's death was an event that made me look at every moment as sacred. So the death itself as an event wasn't sacred to me, but it made me realize all of the things that I had focused on, important career or money or all of those things. Those were all this weird preamble that I had been creating for some life that I was going to have later.
Right.
And instead of realizing, you know, that's kind of now, and if I have the same thing happen to me or something similar happens to me as Christopher, I'm going to be really upset at myself that I had spent all this time getting ready to do something when it was the, hey, you know, your best years were just, why did you squander them? Why didn't you realize they were sacred?
Right.
And it's unfortunate that it's so hard to hang on to that clarity.
Yes.
And it's so hard to get without experiencing something so painful.
Suffering first breaks you, then strengthens you.
Mm-hmm. So it wasn't just a moment, you know. I mean, it was a process, and the whole thing was sacred. And I remember really, really clearly. Because I hadn't been here, you know, very long, and then Christopher got this, and there was the transplant, and it was the Saturday morning, and I remember being in that waiting room up at UW Hospital, and here was the Christopher's family, and then on the other end was another family, and across the hall was another family. There was maybe 4 groups. Mm-hmm. And they were all there because of transplants, you know.
From the same person. The same 31-year-old woman.
And, wow. I mean, that was really, really powerful.
Right.
And so there was more than one life coming out of that person. And and hopefully in all our dying, there's more life coming out of it. You know, I mean, there's life comes out of it in different ways, you know.
Right. Yeah.
So.
Yeah. And I think there's something to say about when we finally gave up the fight, you know. And Jeff has a great quote in the book about that part of the reason that I think our family... I mean, we did not want Christopher to die. Absolutely, we did not. But we felt afterwards that we had done everything that we could for him. He had never spent a night in the hospital alone. We had used, what you said, a small country's GDP worth of money on his medical treatment. You know, really no stone had been unturned in terms of really trying to make his life and his death as good as it could be. And we took a lot of peace in that. And that's why I think, you know, when a child dies and you know they're going to die, you have that time to be able to do all that for him. The downside is you have to watch the suffering, and that was difficult. But at the same time, I've had friends who have lost kids to suicide or to sudden death from an accident. And I think that is far harder because you didn't get all that last minute to say everything you wanted to say and to do everything you wanted to do. Right? So we were blessed that way.
I want to close with some words from Christopher himself. And this was the Mr. Krupp, that writing teacher at Yelm?
Yeah, at Yelm.
Yeah, at Yelm High School. This is the last journal entry, was a letter to Mr. Krupp. And this is what it says. I want to thank you for being a great as well as understanding teacher. It seems as though you found your call early in life and have done what you love as your career. You are lucky. Sit back and relax sometimes and just enjoy being alive. Don't let the petty things or even the important things distract you. Just postpone everything for a second and wallow in the glory of life. Those moments are few and far between, so enjoy them while you can. You never know when those glory days will end. I'm not a worldly person, but there are certain life lessons I've learned. Love everything. Love your successes as well as your failures. Love those you hate, and love those you love harder. Even disappointments are part of the human experience. Go home, hug your son, and kiss your wife. Be thankful for all that is taken for granted, down to the dust and the bugs. In the absence of those little unimportant things, your life is changed. Only when taken away are they appreciated. Accept all. Every person has at least something redeeming about him or her. There is no such thing as a not worthwhile meeting. There are no enemies, only friends you haven't yet met. Enjoy it while you can. It's been nice knowing you. Have a nice life. Chris. I think that's just a touching end to a beautiful witness and testimony and honesty. And thank you for sharing his life with us and your lives as well. So thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.